instead of there's no possible way to cover everything. I'm trying to think of a nice way to wrap up or present something which is useful for application or for practice. And what came to mind was a particular discourse, and I'll just read it first and then I'll explicate a few points which I thought were quite useful. And I would say it's a gem of a discourse. Mm-hmm. It's in the Samyutta Nikaya, which is the connected discourses, soon to be coming to your bookstores. At least Amazon will certainly have them. But it's a new translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi, and it's in terms of a collection of discourses of the Buddhas. It's wonderful. And this is one discourse. It's called the Upanisa Sutta, which Upanisa is another term for conditions, so that it's and sort of the discourse on conditions. So this is discourse takes place at Savatthi, which is where the Buddha spent the majority of his life, or more than any other place. He was a wandering teacher, but Savatthi was the place where his largest monastery was and where he spent the longest time. He says, "Whoa, where'd that go?" Bhikkhus, I say that the destruction of the taints, and that's the asavas, or the outflows that I talked about, the fundamental defilements. I say that the destruction of the taints is for one who knows and sees, not for one who does not know and see. For one who knows and sees what? For one who sees what does the destruction of the taints come about? Such is form. Such its origin, such its passing away. Such is feeling, such is perception, such are volitional formations, such is consciousness. So those are the five khandhas, the five aggregates of being. So such is consciousness, such is its origin, such is its passing away. It is for one who knows thus, for one who sees thus, that the destruction of the taints comes about. I say, bhikkhus, that the knowledge of destruction in regard to destruction, say destruction of those taints, has a proximate cause. It does not lack a proximate cause. And what is the proximate cause for the knowledge of destruction of the taints? It should be said, liberation. I say, bhikkhus, that liberation too has a proximate cause. It does not lack a proximate cause. And what is the proximate cause for liberation? It should be said, dispassion. I say, bhikkhus, that dispassion, too, has a proximate cause. It does not lack a proximate cause. And what is the proximate cause for dispassion? It should be said, disenchantment. I say, bhikkhus, that disenchantment, too, has a proximate cause. It does not lack a proximate cause. And what is the proximate cause for disenchantment? It should be said, the knowledge and vision of things as they really are. I say, bhikkhus, that the knowledge and vision of things as they really are, too, has a proximate cause. It does not lack a proximate cause. And what is the proximate cause for the knowledge and vision of things as they really are? It should be said, concentration, not samadhi. I say, bhikkhus, that concentration too has approximate cause. It does not lack approximate cause. And what is the proximate cause for concentration? It should be said, happiness. I say, bhikkhus, that happiness too has approximate cause. It does not lack approximate cause. And what is the proximate cause for happiness? It should be said, tranquility. I say, bhikkhus, that tranquility too has approximate cause. It does not lack approximate cause. And what is the proximate cause for tranquility? It should be said, rapture, or sometimes it's translated as joy. I say, bhikkhus, that rapture or joy too has approximate cause. It does not lack approximate cause. And what is the proximate cause for rapture? It should be said, gladness. And sometimes that's translated as well-being. I say, bhikkhus, that gladness too has approximate cause. It does not lack approximate cause. And what is the proximate cause for gladness? It should be said, faith, or saddha, or confidence. I say, bhikkhus, that faith too has approximate cause. It does not lack approximate cause. And what is the proximate cause for faith? It should be said, suffering. I say, bhikkhus, that suffering too has approximate cause. It does not lack approximate cause. And what is the proximate cause for suffering? It should be said, birth. And then it ties into the whole, birth having the proximate cause of existence or being or becoming, and then being having the proximate cause of attachment, attachment having the proximate cause of desire or craving, craving having a cause of feeling, the whole dependent origination. Because of our feeling having the, and going back to contact, the six sense bases, name and form, consciousness, volitional formations. And I say, because that volitional formations too have approximate cause. They do not lack approximate cause. And what is the proximate cause for volitional formations? It should be said, ignorance. Thus, bhikkhus, with ignorance as proximate cause, volitional formations come to be. With volitional formations as proximate cause, consciousness. Consciousness as the cause, name and form. With name and form as the cause, proximate cause, six sense bases. And through to... with birth as the cause, suffering. With suffering as the cause, faith. With faith as the proximate cause, gladness. With gladness as proximate cause, rapture. With rapture as proximate cause, tranquility. With tranquility as proximate cause, happiness. With happiness as proximate cause, concentration. With concentration as proximate cause, knowledge and vision of things as they really are. With knowledge and vision of things as they really are, disenchantment. And with disenchantment as proximate cause, dispassion. With dispassion as proximate cause, liberation. With liberation as proximate cause, the knowledge of the destruction of the asavas, of the outflows. Just as bhikkhus, when rain pours down in thick droplets on a mountaintop, the water flows down along the slope and fills the cleft, gullies, and creeks. These being full, fill up the pools. These being full, fill up the lakes. These being full, fill up the streams. These being full, fill up the rivers. And these being full, fill up the great ocean. So too, with ignorance as proximate cause, volitional formations come to be. That image of the... of the rain coming down on the mountaintop, and then it's not a linear thing. This sense of filling and spilling over and conditioning and moving seamlessly through things. So that how this process of causes work back and forth. And of course, the really neat cause of the coming to suffering, and then it being the cause for faith, for satthā, confidence in the teachings, confidence in the practice, because one sees that there is a way out. There isn't. It's just sort of eternal and unmitigated suffering. there is something else than that, and that sort of this causal process isn't about just sort of how. I mean, it is about how suffering comes to be, but it's also how does suffering not come to be? How does suffering cease? How do we become free of suffering? And when we see the way out, then there is this quality of faith. And then there's this really lovely sequence of very positive mental states, with faith as the condition. Then there's this quality of gladness or well-being, pamojin, and with this gladness or well-being, then there's a quality of joy. With joy as condition, then there is this quality of tranquility. Joy is kind of exciting. Bhīti is the Pali word for joy. And then with bhīti as the cause, and tranquility is pasati, and it has a quality of relaxing, softening. This tranquility, this being settled. And with tranquility as the cause, it's a cause for happiness. And happiness is sukha, and it has the quality, it's the opposite of dukkha, sukha and dukkha. So dukkha is, sukha is your opposite of dukkha. And this happiness, and it's a happiness of, say, a pervasive happiness, body and mind, a pervasive feeling of happiness. The mind is bright. This happiness, very positive. The body is completely at ease. And then, with happiness as the cause, concentration. And samadhi, the word, what we're usually looking for when we meditate, the sense of, almost invariably it's translated as concentration in English, and I much prefer the Thai when it's translated into Thai, it means the firm establishing of the mind, and that's a really nice way to picture that, to feel that, rather than concentration, which has a quotation of forcing the mind to be a certain way, really controlling the mind, concentrating it, being on top of it, the mind firmly established. And its cause is happiness. This is, and in other discourses, this sequence actually comes up in many, many discourses. in the discourses around development of the spiritual faculties, spiritual path, meditation training, there's that sequence of gladness, of joy, of tranquility, happiness, and then concentration. And the Buddha says in many places, when he goes through that, the happy mind is easily concentrated. And you know, it's very worthy of note, because we tend to go about it the other way, in that if only I could get my samadhi together, if only I could get my concentration together, then I would be happy. We suffer accordingly. It has that result. It doesn't make one feel comfortable, at ease. So that sense of paying attention to how do we settle the mind in a way that is brings about well-being, happiness, laying the foundations for well-being and happiness, and then trusting in this process there's interesting, this sequence has in different discourses that the Buddha talks about or teaches, there are different entry points that, so like in this one it's faith. In other discourses that there is moral conduct. And because of moral conduct, there is a quality of non-remorse or lack of remorse. And with non-remorse as condition, then there's a feeling of gladness. And then it goes in, kicks into the thing up to liberation, destruction of the asuras. Other discourses, the Buddha uses wise reflection, or this term can be translated in many different ways. Wise reflection, ordered attention, skillful consideration. You get the picture. In the Pali, it's yoniso manasikara. Manasikara is thinking or attention, attentiveness to an object. Yoniso is going to the source. Yoni is the womb. So that going to the origin of things, going to the source of things. So with attention going to the source, with ordered attention, with skillful application of mind. And then we say with this wise reflection, then there's the arising of gladness and the kicking into the sequence. So that this sense of the importance of paying attention to well-being, paying attention to happiness. One does not have to feel guilty if one actually tries to make one's meditation comfortable or pleasant. It's not against the rule. It's okay to enjoy yourself. Which, you know, is a radical concept. there is a real sort of deep-seated feeling that we've really got to suffer a lot. We've really got to pay our dues, and we've really got to sweat bullets over this meditation stuff. And You know, and it's difficult enough as it is, without adding to it. Ajahn Sumedho, Ajahn Chah's senior Western disciple, who most of you probably have met him, and he's here, visits Portland from time to time because his sister's here. There was one winter retreat where he took dependent origination as a theme and talked about it, and just like for the whole retreat. He put his twist on the first link of the chain of the avijja paccaya sankhara, with ignorance as condition, and volitional formations come to be, and sankharas can be translated as volitional formations. They can be translated as compounded things. They can be translated as a thought process, thought formations, mental formations. But Ajahn Sumedho sort of turned that around and says, with avijja paccaya sankhara, said, ignorance complicates everything. And that's just really how it is. When we really don't see things as they truly are, everything gets complicated, everything gets complex, everything gets very, very difficult. So that this sense of really paying attention or investigating, how this process works, how can we understand it, how can we work with it, how can we use it as a tool for our increasing clarity? How can we apply it so that these positive mental states, feelings, can arise, and in the same way as the streams fill up and fill the as we plant the seeds of awareness and understanding and of faith, well-being, that they naturally lead to the quality of seeing things as they truly are, and to disenchantment. Say, when one sees things as they truly are, the word is disenchantment. Actually, in this, it's translated as revulsion. Strong stuff. Other words that I've seen.
Disgust.
Yeah, disgust. I've seen it translated as disgust. The word is nipita, and it is a turning away from. And the early translators, it probably does. There is this sense. One is profoundly bored with the world and with conditioned existence. One's profoundly disinterested, but it comes from a place of incredible tranquility, joy, well-being, happiness. It's because the heart is full and sees things as they truly are, that nothing else tastes good. Nothing else attracts. Nothing. One isn't. It just doesn't. The flickering mind doesn't. It doesn't bite. It doesn't want it. So that there's this disenchantment, and But the quality of heart that is disenchanted is not, say, overwhelmed or negative or averse in any way. It's like, it's replete, it's full. And why would it want anything else? So that that quality of dispassion is what sets in. So this tremendous cooling of the heart, and that's one of the words that Nibbana is translated as, is depicted as this, as a cooling, being that sort of the heat of passion is just not there. The heat of searching and looking for something that is finally going to satisfy one, and something out there that is going to make me happy, something out there that is that's going to really fulfill me. There's a cooling that is completely transformative and completely stilling. So that they, with dispassion, and liberation, the heart is free. This freedom is, and it's a, let's say, the sense, this natural filling, in the same way that the ocean is filled because of the big rivers and the small, and starting from the little droplets of rain that start up on the mountaintops, it all comes together to fill the ocean. And in the same way, the heart that is liberated, that is completely free, starts from all these little causes and conditions that we put into it in a very careful and a very positive way. The heart is not freed by mandating it, or by just trying to force it somehow. One has to fulfill the appropriate conditions. So that sense of the liberation is this natural causal process. It's not anything strange. It's not anything magical or even mystical. This is natural. When the causes are put in, then the result is that. It puts in the causes for freedom, liberation is the result. So that those that process is to be internalized and reflected on, brought into being. Because this is such a large topic, I haven't really opened things up to questions, I think I'll give a bit of time now for questions, if anybody has any.
Yeah. The 12 steps start with the ignorance. I was looking through the Peyoto, however you pronounce it, and I believe you said that you can really start at any step in the cycle and feed your way around. I don't quite understand that.
Yeah. That's a good point. It's best depicted as a circle, which has a starting point, because a circle doesn't have a starting point, rather than a line which starts here and ends there, and that's why, say, in your artistic depictions of dependent origination. It is depicted as the, and it's called the wheel of life, and it's depicted as a circle with the, with these conditions. So each once you're hooked into the wheel, you know, at any point, you know, wherever it starts, it can be, you know, you're into that wheel. So whether it because at some and there are points which are, say, natural inroads, in the sense of, because some are the input which we give in terms of present karma or present action, clinging, desire. That's a reaction to feeling. Or the input of and it's arising from sense content, or the input of ignorance or desire, you know, having the quality of not knowing, and then reacting from that point. You know, that's another point where one starts the process. It's also interesting in terms of the dependent origination. When the Buddha talked about dependent origination, it's not just one formula. This sort of that 12-fold link chain is one of the ways that he talks about it. And there's somewhere he hits 10, somewhere it's 8, somewhere it's 6, somewhere it's just a few parts. But you know, each depicts the fact that, say, dependent conditionality or dependent co-arising, this cause and because of this cause and condition process, the quality of suffering comes to be, and then and similarly the cessation comes to be. There's places where the Buddha doesn't bring it back all the way to ignorance. You know, stop at name and form and consciousness, and say that, and actually say, you know, this mind it does not go beyond consciousness, in the sense. Name and form are dependent on consciousness. Consciousness is dependent on name and form. These depend on each other, and that the and is compared to two sheaves of rice straw. If one is taken away, then the other one falls down. So that's, and there's also many discourses where the Buddha just takes, you know, a snippet of it, and then extrapolates or expounds the teaching from that. There's also a whole kind of way of interpreting dependent origination, which is. Say predominant in the commentarial literature is interpreting it in terms of the rebirth process, and looking at it on a sort of macrocosmic scale, and looking at it as this is the way samsara functions and works, and this is how beings are born and reborn in the world, and then there's other ways of looking at it in terms of the you know, the process of the heart or the mind, the present moment. So it's just used in so many different ways.
When you were talking about developing causes that lead to liberation, joy, it's leading to tranquility, or mm-hmm. with the rising of this, there's the rising of this, and liberation at the end. Is liberation then conditioned in the sense that if it arises, it can also
cease. Yeah. There is the conditions for liberation. There's the conditions for the destruction of the asavas, which are the underlying tendencies within the mind stream that lead to say buying into this whole process, so that once that has been understood and seen, then that process falls apart. Now, the seeing of that dependent origination, or seeing of the causal process so clearly that it causes a radical relinquishment and penetration, say entering the stream of Dhamma, is still your, say that's still your first stage of say liberation, and one still has tendencies which are not dealt with, and that continuing the process. But if one, so that on that level, that knowledge of liberation, on that level, is still subject to, say, falling back into defilement to a certain level, which is, the Buddha compared the amount of suffering that one has left. He was in Rajgaha, where he had the first monastery was established, actually, and was the center of the Magadhan kingdom. There are five hills surrounding Rajgaha. One of them is Waipulam. The realization of stream entry, sort of, he said he compared the amount of suffering that one had dealt with and had freed oneself from was about the size of this Waipula mountain, and what was still left to deal with, and sort of put his finger into the dirt and what he could pile up on the end of his finger, that's what's left. And a major shift, major change. There's still work to do, but one's really, really shifted, really changed. And but one still suffers, and so that the goal of practice and training is liberation. So that and one of the terms for, say, a fully liberated being is the akupa jeta vimutti. Akupa jeta vimutti is the liberation of the heart, and akupa is this unchangeable or not non-regressible, so non-regressible liberation, unshakable. Is what normally is translated as unshakable deliverance of the heart. Definitely desirable. One of the things, before I even came here this morning, we were, Tenso Dento and I were sitting around having coffee at breakfast time and sort of chatting. And Tenso Dento mentioned that reflecting or remembering when in the end of June, beginning of July, we went down to listen to teachings of His Holiness the Dalai Lama in Los Angeles. And His Holiness talked about dependent origination and put it very nicely that, you know, by seeing dependent origination is how one sees emptiness. Like, and because in the particularly in the Mahayana traditions, Vajrayana traditions, emptiness gets really big billing, and it can turn into almost like a metaphysical state, and it's not, that's not what it is. It's by seeing like empty, everything is empty because it's dependently arisen. Nothing has an independent existence, therefore it's empty. It's not this sort of ethereal vacuumous state that's, you know, sitting beside phenomena. Phenomena are already empty because they are dependently arisen. So that seeing dependent origination, one is at any point, that is how one is seeing, perceiving, working with emptiness. So that quality of the practicality of emptiness as a teacher is very, when one ties it into dependent origination, the emptiness becomes very important. You know, it's very interesting. The pull out my trusty. there's a very neat discourse that the Buddha gave, and it's in the connected discourses, and it's considered to be the discourse which Nagarjuna took as his the basis for the whole of the sort of the Madhyamika philosophy, creating the whole structure of you know, this philosophy, which is it is very profound, it is amazing. Emptiness plays an enormous role in the Madhyamika philosophy, which is the philosophy of the middle way. But Nagarjuna, by all accounts, was not his purpose was to set up a separate philosophical school. What he was trying to do was to balance the views that were starting to be held of solidifying the self, solidifying the world, and the whole sort of range of views that come from that. So that apparently Nagarjuna is trying to say, bring people back to the, say, the view of the Buddha. And of course, that got turned into a whole separate philosophical school in Buddhism. And emptiness becomes almost reified. It becomes very, very solid. But I'll read this this to you. And this is a discussion between the Buddha and Kachayana, a disciple. And Kachayana asks, Lord, right view is said. What does right view refer to? Usually, Kachayana, this world depends upon the dualism of existence and non-existence. But when one sees the world's origin as it actually is with right understanding, there is for him none of what is called non-existence in the world. And when he sees the world's cessation as it actually is with right understanding, there is for him none of what is called existence in the world. Seeing being and non-being, seeing arising and seeing ceasing. One doesn't cling to a particular position. You see them causally again. Usually the world is shackled by bias, clinging and insistence. But one such as this, who has right view, instead of allowing bias, instead of clinging, and instead of deciding about, quote-unquote, myself, with such bias, such clinging, and such mental decision in the guise of underlying tendency to insist, he has no doubt or uncertainty that what arises is only arising suffering, and what ceases is only ceasing suffering. And in this, his knowledge is independent of others. That is what right view refers to. And all exists is one extreme, and all does not exist is the other extreme. Instead of resorting to either extreme, a perfect one expounds the Dhamma by the middle way. It is with ignorance as condition that formations come to be. With formations as condition, consciousness is come. It goes into dependent origination. That's when we talk about karma, and it's sort of the action, whether it's physical, mental, or verbal, that is acted upon from that, are acting upon things from a place of either avicca, ignorance, or icha, knowledge. Because there is an unbinding that takes place also. So the karma or action is whatever action comes about is, say, conditioned by either the say it's forward going towards something, or it's reverse ceasing or something. And then karma is just a neutral manifestation, unless you're at the end of, unless you're at the suffering end. Of. It's about 4:30. Why don't we just have a quiet sit? Finish the day quietly. If anybody wants to stand up and stretch a little bit, we have been sitting for a while. So that. pretty much ends the day. And I thank you all for your patience. I hope that it provides some, it has provided some food for thought, and using dependent origination as a reflection, and say taking it with you for reflection, also taking it with you in terms of say investigating it further. I've scratched the surface a little bit, and that it's up to each person to sort of take it and see what see what's really underneath. I'd like to end with a chant, which is the dedication of merit or sharing of blessings, coming together and practicing the Dhamma together, listening to teachings. This is something which is a great great benefit, great merit. So to share it freely with others, and all the goodness that has been collected. Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana. In every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble Lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.